Ladies and gentlemen, in the previous lectures, I've discussed, first of all, the idea of bridges between the scientific and factual side of our experience and the value side, and secondly, the facts of our present treatment of the planet and the state of the planet, and finally, the ideas and values and philosophies which are appropriate to those facts. Today I want to pass on from our planet to our species to see what is happening to the human species, and at the end of the lecture to think a little about what should be our attitude towards it, what should be our philosophy, and our ethical outlook on the subject. This is essentially about human numbers and their relations to human well-being and to human values in general. Well, we can, by very approximately, calculate more or less what numbers were in the past. Needless to say, any accurate estimation of numbers is very recent, but we can extrapolate into the past and come to what seem to be fairly good conclusions. There are a number of experts have ventured into the field, and though there are fairly wide margins of difference between them, the numbers they come to are roughly in agreement. They are agreed that in pre-agricultural days, for example, in the lower Paleolithic times, when man was a food-gathering creature, there were probably not more than 20 million humans on the whole planet. In later Paleolithic times, when organized hunting had been invented by human beings, the number probably doubled. There were perhaps 40 million people on the entire planet. We can make a rough estimate, for example, of what an organized hunting people could do from the numbers who were present, the Indians who were present in North America when the white man arrived. It seems pretty clear that there were not more than 1 million Indians in the entire North American continent east of the Rockies, which gives one an indication of the extremely low density of population which is possible in a hunting economy. Well, then the Great Revolution came about 6,000 BC with the invention of agriculture and the creation of cities, which began in the next millennia. By about 1,000 BC, after 5,000 years of agriculture, the numbers were probably up to about 100 million in the world. Then at the beginning of the Christian era, this figure had a little more than doubled. It was somewhere between 200 million and 250 million, which is less than half the present population of China. But this, on the first Christmas day, this probably was roughly the number of people in the world. Well, the population gradually increased, extremely gradually. Sometimes there were long periods of standstill. Sometimes there were even periods of decrease, as, for example, in the years immediately following 1348, when the Black Death killed off certainly 30% of the population of Europe, and nobody knows what percentage of the population of Asia. But anyhow, by the time the Pilgrim Fathers arrived in this country, it's estimated that the population was about twice what it had been on the first Christmas day. That is to say, it had doubled in 1,600 years, which is an extremely slow rate of increase, as you can see. Well, then, from that time on, from about the middle of the 17th century, with the first beginnings of the Industrial Revolution and the first importations of food from the newly developed lands of the New World, a new era of population growth began, and population began rising far more rapidly than it had ever risen before. By the time the Declaration of Independence was signed, the world figure for human population was probably around 700 million. It must have passed the billion mark fairly early in the 19th century and was stood at about 1,400 million, I imagine, around the time when I was born in the 1890s. Well, now the striking fact is that since the time that I was born, the population of the planet has doubled. It has passed from 1,400 millions, which is already twice what it was at the signing of the Declaration of Independence, to 2,800 millions, 2.8 billions. And the rate of increase now is such that it will probably double again in rather under 50 years. The rates of increase, you see, have been increasing along with the absolute increase of population. The net rate of increase did not reach 1% per annum until the beginning of this century. It has now risen to 1.6 per annum for an average of the world at large, and there are considerable areas of the world where it exceeds 2% and reaches even 3% or more per annum. A 3% increase leads, on the basis of compound interest, because of course population increases as money increases by compound interest, a 3% increase doubles the population in about 25 years, and a 1.5% increase in about 50, a 1.6% increase, therefore will double it in somewhat less than 50 years. Well, these facts are sufficiently extraordinary. I mean, they indicate clearly enough that we are living in an entirely unprecedented world in regard to this fundamental fact of human existence, the numbers of the human race and their relationship with planetary resources. Nothing like this has ever existed before. I mean, the fact that we never reached 1% until the 20th century, and that in the short time since about 1905, when this peak was reached, we've already pushed the figure up to 1.6%, indicates very clearly that we are living in a world for which there are no historical precedents whatsoever, and that we have to resign ourselves to the fact that we have to think in entirely new ways about a problem which our fathers never had any occasion to think about intensively. At the present time, of course, the increase, there are large differentials between the increase in different parts of the world. Europe, Western Europe, had its great increase during the 18th and 19th centuries. Although, as I say, the increase never came up even to 1% per annum, it was very rapid and startling at the time, the vast increase of numbers which went on in Europe during the 19th century. And it has now reached about 400 millions and is increasing now at a rate under 1% per annum for Western Europe, although at a higher rate for Eastern Europe. And it's thought that it will take about 100 years for at the present rate for Europe to double itself again. But meanwhile, other parts of the world which were not increasing rapidly have begun to increase at a great rate. And we are seeing now the kind of thing that happened in Europe 100 years or 150 years ago, happening on an enormous scale in Asia, in Africa, in South America, in the Caribbean islands. There is this explosive increase going on. And as I say, it's a differential increase, that over the greater part of the Western world, the increase is considerably less than it is in the world, the Asiatic and African world. Now, let us consider the reasons for the steps in the increments of population in the past. As I said at the beginning of the lecture, the primitive man was limited simply by his methods of collecting food. If you are just a food collector wandering about picking up acorns and snails and frogs and things, you obviously can support an extremely small population. When hunting becomes organized, when you have flint arrows and when you've invented the bow, when you have fire hunts and organize whole tribes to chase the game, then you can support considerably more. The experts think that the population doubled then. Well, and then, of course, with the invention of agriculture, you immediately get a very great increase. It becomes possible to pass to a much higher level of production and to found cities, to create the division of labor, and in fact to create what we call civilization. Well, this went on, this proto-agricultural era lasted with very few changes until the later 17th century, when we got the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and the first results of the exploitation of virgin lands in the New World. It then became possible to supply Europe with large quantities of food, cheap food, from these virgin lands, and this is what made possible at that time what is called the Industrial Revolution. Without the supply of cheap food from the New World, it probably would have been impossible for Europe to industrialize as it did. But owing to this strange historical accident, that there were vast lands suddenly being opened up, and that the products, the cereals from these lands could be exported to Europe, it was possible to take a great many peasants off the land in Europe and put them into factories and to keep them fed while they were building up the new industrial revolution, the new industrial society. And it was this extra supply of food which initiated the modern advance in population. Population generally tends to live up to the food supply in the natural world. All species live up to their supply of food and then are wiped out as they exceed, as the numbers outrun the supply. But in recent years, a new factor has entered into the picture, which is the factor based upon discoveries in physiology and medicine, the factor of public health. This is a most startling, when we consider the immense influence this has had in recent years. That what is happening now is that not that the birth rate is being increased, in fact, in many cases, it's being slightly decreased, but that the death rate has been lowered to a startling extent, mainly by public health measures. Well, this began already in the 19th century, the beginnings of people realizing that you had to have clean water, for example, even before the Pasteur's discovery of bacteria. This had begun to dawn upon people that it was a good thing to be clean. It's interesting in this context to read about the early efforts of the disciples of Bentham, the utilitarian philosopher, to clean up London. For a long time, the rich in London, who lived in their part of the town, were entirely indifferent to the appalling conditions which prevailed in the eastern end of the city. But they began to take some interest when the cholera and other diseases were typhus, which raged in the East End chronically, the typhus did, began to invade the smarter sections of the West End. After that, they decided that probably something had better be done about it. And it's remarkable that men like Kay Shuttleworth succeeded in about 40 years in transforming London from a pest hole of the most revolting character into a relatively clean city. And the result was, of course, a very rapid rise, a dramatic rise, in the expectation of life. The expectation of life in ancient Rome, as in modern Asia, was about 30 years, the average expectation. And the average expectation of life is in the United States and Great Britain now just about 70 years. So that you see there is a most startling change here. And today, with the newest instruments and weapons in the public health armory, the most amazing revolutionary changes can be brought about in an extraordinarily short space of time. The two most powerful weapons, of course, are the antibiotics and the insecticides. The discovery, for example, that malaria and yellow fever were insect-borne diseases, and the discovery of that other tropical diseases like bilharziosis were also carried by small-scale animals, has permitted the most revolutionary changes to be carried out in a very, very short space of time. As an example, consider the case of Ceylon, where the population was held almost stationary by endemic malaria. Well, after the end of the Second World War, teams were sent into Ceylon with DDT, and malaria was completely stamped out of the island in less than 5 years. Well, when one considers that malaria, which had been endemic in Western Europe for centuries, it was endemic, for example, all along the Thames estuary in London, when one thinks that it took at least 300 years of draining of the soil and drying up the area to get rid of the mosquito, and therefore to get rid of malaria, which you will find mentioned constantly in the plays of Shakespeare under the word ague. People suffer from the ague, the tertian, the quartan ague. That it took, as I say, about 3 centuries of hard work in Britain to get rid of malaria. It took 5 years with modern methods in Ceylon to get rid of it. Well, what were the results? I mean, we have this terrible ambivalent fact that you have people saved from the miseries of malaria, and the fact that a large proportion of them die in early life or in middle life from the disease. But the net result has been as follows. The birth rate has remained what it was during the period when, say, 3 out of 5 children regularly died, and when it was necessary to have large families in order to preserve the race at its existing levels. The birth rate, as I say, has remained where it was in the upper 30s, 30 per thousand. The death rate, meanwhile, has fallen very nearly to European levels, a little over 10, as far as I remember. And the result of this is that the population of Ceylon is now increasing at the rate of 3% per annum, which means that it will double in 24 years. And the land is not elastic. Some new land will come in owing to the fact that it can now be plowed under because of the destruction of the malaria mosquito. But meanwhile, incredible problems have already arisen. They're finding it more and more difficult to feed the population on their local resources. The exportable crops such as tea and rubber do not really suffice to buy sufficient food. Capital is extremely difficult to come by because there simply isn't enough money circulating for people to save. And nobody really quite knows what on earth is going to happen when the population doubles. And this same situation, of course, is particularly striking in many island communities where there is no possibility of expansion. It's very striking in Mauritius. It's striking even in some of the Mediterranean islands, such as Sardinia and Sicily. It's a fearful problem throughout the Caribbean. I was talking last year with the Prime Minister of the new Commonwealth of the Caribbean, Sir Grantley Adams, who previously was the Prime Minister of Barbados, and he was telling me about the state of his home island. Barbados now has a population of 1,400 to the square mile, with only one crop and one industry, the sugar crop, no other resources at all, and nobody has the faintest idea of what is going to happen, how they're going to get on in the future. And Barbados is only slightly worse, in a worse condition than many of the other islands. And one has this, confronted with this painful fact that this newly independent community is probably non-viable from an economic point of view and will probably become worse as time goes on, owing to the increasing pressure of population upon resources. And the same situation can be seen in Egypt, for example, where at the present time something like 25 million people are trying to make a living off 5.25 million acres of arable land. And what is going to be done there? And here one can put in parenthetically the fact that the fundamental reason why Egyptian policy has been so troublesome to the West in recent years is a biological reason. These people cannot live on their resources, and they must somehow throw their weight around so as to get people who have capital to invest in the country, and that it's completely pointless to envisage the politics of such a country as Egypt, and indeed of many other countries of the world, purely from a political point of view. You have to think in terms of biology of these people to form any understanding and to formulate any sensible policy in regard to them. We shall come into this matter a little bit later. Meanwhile, let us ask ourselves what we can do. What are the alternatives that confront us in regard to this problem of population growth? What are the practical alternatives? First of all, there's one alternative is to do nothing in particular about it, just to let the things go on as they are. Well, the consequences of that, I think, are quite clear, that if we do nothing whatever about it and continue as we're going now, the problem will not be solved by us. The problem will be solved by nature in the way that nature always solves the problems of overpopulation. I mean, when any animal population exceeds the resources available to it, tends to starve, and B, it tends to get severe diseases, epidemic, epizootic diseases. And in the human population, we can envisage the natural check on the unlimited growth of population will be precisely this. There will be pestilence, famine, and since we are human beings and not animals, organized warfare, which will bring the numbers down to what the earth can carry. Well, this is obviously a highly undesirable solution. And our problem is surely to find out how we can re-establish the balance. As I stressed in the last lecture, what nature teaches us is that everything must be in balance. This is extraordinarily dangerous to upset any of the fundamental balances of nature. And we are in process of upsetting a fundamental balance in the most alarming and drastic manner. And our problem is, are we going to restore the balance in the natural way, which is a brutal and entirely anti-human way, or are we going to establish it in some intelligent, rational, and humane way? Well, as I say, if we leave matters as they are, certainly nature will solve the problem in her way and not in ours. The next way, of course, is to increase resources, to increase industrial and agricultural production so that it can catch up with the increase in population. Well, this is extremely like what happens in the Alice Through the Looking Glass, where, if you remember, when Alice and the Red Queen are together, they start running at a tremendous rate. And to Alice's astonishment, when they've run till they're completely out of breath, they're in exactly the same place. And Alice says, "But in my country, if we run as fast as this, we get somewhere." And the Red Queen answers, yours must be a very slow country. In this country, we have to run as fast as we can to stay in the same place. And if we want to get anywhere else, we have to run twice as fast. And this is a comic parable regarding the extremely tragic situation in which we now find ourselves, that we have to work, we have to put forth the most enormous efforts in order to stand where we are. And where we are is in a most undesirable position, because as the most recent figures issued by the United Nations indicate, something like two-thirds of the human race are now living on a diet of 2,000 calories or less, which is definitely a diet of undernourishment, the ideal being in the neighborhood of 3,000. And the situation has, it would appear, been getting slightly worse in recent years. All observers in the Food and Agriculture Organization and other international organizations busy with this problem are agreed on this, that the situation on the whole is a little worse than it was 30 or 40 years ago, that the average individual has less to eat and fewer goods than he had in the past. And actually, the overall figures seem to be that whereas 30 years ago, something like 50% of the population was definitely undernourished, nearer 65% are undernourished today. So that there does seem to be a steady worsening of the situation. The extraordinary difficulty of keeping up with this increase of population can easily be envisaged if we just think of the figures. You see, in a country which is increasing very rapidly, say such as Mexico or Guatemala or Ceylon, 3% per annum increase, in order to stand where they are now, all production, agricultural and industrial, must increase 3% per annum in order to preserve an extraordinarily low and unsatisfactory state of living. And if there's to be any improvement, the increase must be certainly 4% per annum and preferably 5% per annum. Well, it's quite extraordinarily difficult to keep up an increase of agricultural production of 2 or 3 or 4% per annum. I mean, this was done in Japan for about 40 or 50 years by the most extraordinary efforts and by the amazing industry of the Japanese, but it's extremely unlikely that it can be done in many other parts of the world. And above all, it's extraordinarily difficult for this to be achieved in any underdeveloped country, where there is, first of all, a prodigious lack of capital. The reason for the lack of capital is very simple. Capital, after all, is what remains, the margin that remains when the fundamental needs of the population have been satisfied. Well, in most of these underdeveloped countries, the fundamental needs of the population are never satisfied. So there is practically no capital left over. There is no savings. It's incredible how little capital, for example, a country like India can raise. The last figures I saw from the United Nations were that most Western countries have about at their disposal about 70 times as much capital as the underdeveloped countries. Well, at the present moment, the underdeveloped countries have about 70 times as much need of capital as the developed countries. And this again illustrates this terribly significant and painfully true statement in the gospel: to those who have shall be given, from those who have not shall be taken away even that which they have. And this raises the most extraordinary problem, merely this question of capital, the difficulty of finding capital for the underdeveloped countries in order to keep up merely with the position they are now in. Along with this, needless to say, there are great shortages in trained manpower, which are just as necessary as adequate supplies of capital, so that it seems extremely difficult to envisage the possibility of increasing production sufficiently, not merely to keep to outrun the increase in population, but merely to keep up with that increase. Well, this is our second alternative. The third alternative is to try to increase production as much as possible, and at the same time try to re-establish the balance between the birth rate and the death rate, to try and re-establish it by means less gruesome than those which are used in nature, by intelligent and humane methods. Now, the interesting fact is that the whole idea of the limitation of population is by no means new. In a great many primitive societies, and even in among many of the highly civilized societies of antiquity, where local overpopulation was a menace, methods of limiting population were currently employed. They were methods which we would certainly find extremely undesirable. The most common, of course, was infanticide, of killing or exposing, just leaving out on the mountains unwanted children, or children of the wrong sex, or children who happened to be born with some slight deficiency or other. All these were exposed. Well, this was one method. Then, of course, there was the method of abortion was a very common method. And there were many societies in which strict religious injunctions imposed long periods of sexual continence between the birth of each child, so that this idea of a limitation of population by means less fearful than the natural means, but still in many ways rather undesirable, were well known in other periods of history. And of course, in the 19th and 20th century, various methods of birth control, less fearful nature, have been devised. And it is, in fact, theoretically possible at the present time, theoretically conceivable that such methods might be applied throughout the whole world. But, of course, what is theoretically possible is often practically almost impossible. There are colossal difficulties in the way of implementing any a large-scale policy of limitation of population. And it's worthwhile dwelling for a moment on the nature of these difficulties. In general, we can say that whereas death control is extremely easy under modern circumstances, birth control is extremely difficult. The reason is very simple. Death control, the control, for example, of infectious diseases, can be accomplished by a handful of experts and quite a small labor force of unskilled persons. For example, in the case of Ceylon, the stamping out of malaria was done simply by spraying swamps and pools with DDT and spraying the interior of houses, which required a very small capital expenditure, which practically any very poor government can afford, and required the active work of a very small number of people, a few experts and a few laborers. And similarly with digging wells for clean water, this is quite a cheap procedure. And there are many quite simple ways in which the death rate can be lowered very rapidly by small expenditures and through the implementation of a very few people. But when we come to increasing production or to decreasing the birth rate, we find ourselves confronted with problems which can only be solved by the cooperation of entire populations. Increasing agricultural production requires an immense educational work among millions of smallholders and peasants and farmers. And any policy of birth control requires the cooperation of the entire adult population. And needless to say, the difficulties of communication and of education are almost insuperable. There are very, very great difficulties. So that this remains one of the fundamental reasons why this state of disbalance is likely to continue and for a long time, simply because of the cheapness and the ease of death control, the expense and the difficulty of increasing production and decreasing the birth rate. I've talked a little now about the difficulties of increasing production. Now let us talk a little more about this problem of control of the birth rate. The problem is infinitely complex. It's not merely a problem in medicine, in chemistry, in biochemistry, in physiology. It's also a problem in sociology, a problem in psychology, a problem in theology, a problem in education. It has to be attacked on about 10 different fronts simultaneously if there's to be any hope of solving it. And first of all, for there to be any likelihood of it being successful, there has to be a great deal of fundamental research into biology, into the whole problem of reproduction, in the hope of producing some satisfactory oral contraceptive which can be distributed easily to masses of people and cheaply. And I was talking with researchers in the Rockefeller Institute last year who tell me that they think that there is still a great deal of fundamental research to be done, that we just don't know enough yet to be able to produce an entirely satisfactory oral contraceptive. And of course, unfortunately, very little money is going into this research. In general, far more money goes into physical and chemical research than into biological research, and far more money goes into other forms of biological research than into this particular area. So that there is a great problem there, that we have a long way to go before we have the necessary chemical means. Now that we have to discuss the time factor, which is extremely important. Assuming that enough money and ability is put onto this problem, it can probably be solved within 10 years, that something completely satisfactory may be produced and manufactured in bulk. But we have to remember that within 10 years, the population of the Earth will have increased by 500 million. It's increasing now by about 43 million a year, and the rate is going up each year, so that it will be between 450 and 500 million in 10 years. Well, then we have to consider the time it will take to get the new oral contraceptive accepted by countless millions of men and women all over the world. Well, an interesting research into this problem was undertaken years ago by Beatrice and Sidney Webb, the old Fabian workers in England, who made a historical study of the average time it took for an idea which at its first enunciation seemed revolutionary and revolting, to be taken for granted and to be acted upon by the whole population. And they concluded that the average time it took for this process was 28 years, which is roughly the length of a generation, which is what one would expect, really, because after all, it is very difficult to persuade adult men to change their points of view. And they have to die off in order to get a new generation to accept new ideas. Well, presuming, I mean, if it takes 10 years chemically of basic research to produce what we want and another 28 years, by this time the population of the Earth will have increased by about 1.5 billion. So that again we're up against this awful Alice in Wonderland Alice through the looking glass parable of rushing on in order to stand in the same place. The technical and temporal point of view, we are obviously in a very tight spot. And then we have further to consider the political point of view. There is absolutely no prospect at the present time of our getting any political agreement on a general population policy throughout the world, and there would, I think, undoubtedly have to be either a worldwide agreement or a regional agreement on the problem in order to have any satisfactory control of the situation at all. The trouble is, of course, that our leaders just don't think in biological terms. And here I think it's rather interesting speculation. What would have happened if the only man who did think in biological terms and had a considerable experience in practical biology, who was in politics, what would have happened if he had become President of the United States? I'm referring to Henry Wallace. Henry Wallace was undoubtedly a very bad politician, but he was biologically trained, and he had done something which probably which is more than can be said for any other man in public life that I can think of. He had done something which was unquestionably and unmitigatedly good for the entire human race. He had helped to develop hybrid corn, and which is much more than can be said for anybody else in politics who have never done anything which was good for the whole human race. They may have done something good for part of the human race. But Wallace, whatever his bad qualifications as a politician were, had done something which was certainly good for the entire race, and his mind ran along biological lines. And maybe if we had had a man who thought in these terms, possibly the whole sort of thinking about our problems could have been pushed away from the completely insoluble field of politics towards the possibly soluble field of biology. And we might have seen a policy which made a good deal more sense in the long run than the policy which is now being pursued by all parties, which from the long-range human point of view seems to be a kind of monstrously frivolous and irresponsible fiddling while Rome burns. We fiddle with this awful business of nationalistic power politics when our basic problem is this long-range problem, question of whether the human race, expanding as rapidly as it's doing now, can survive in any decent condition, and what we are to do to preserve the world in any state of tolerable state for our great-grandchildren or even for our grandchildren. And unfortunately, we have missed our chance. That there has never been at the head of a great state a man who was habitually thought in these fundamental biological terms. Well, it may be that we were very lucky in not having Mr. Wallace, but on the other hand, maybe we were very unfortunate in that we didn't, and I don't know. Another problem, which I think we must just briefly mention in regard to the immensely rapid increase in numbers, is the educational problem, that this enormously rapid increase makes it almost impossible to realize the ideal which we have had. I mean, everybody in the world now has this ideal of providing a basic education for everybody. Immense efforts have been made, above all since the end of the Second World War, to provide elementary education throughout the world. But the fact remains, these figures were published just a few months ago by UNESCO, there is no doubt at all that the absolute number of illiterates is greater today than it has ever been, in spite of all the enormous efforts. We have now 800 million children to educate, but we also have 700 million illiterate adults to educate. Well, in the underdeveloped countries, A, there is no capital for building schools, B, there is no tax money for paying teachers, C, there are no trained teachers, I mean, not nearly enough of them. And even in this country, the richest country in the world, grave complaints are heard that schoolrooms are overcrowded, that we don't have enough school buildings and so on. And imagine what the problem is in countries like Mexico or Brazil or Ceylon, where there's a much higher increase and far less resources, both in money and in trained manpower. And we're confronted with this other awful question. Are we just going to go on having more and more illiterate adults than we ever had before? And remember that these will be illiterate adults not within the framework of a traditional civilization, which didn't matter very much if they were illiterate, but within the framework of a traditional civilization which has broken down completely and which is being replaced by the worst features of our own Western civilization. So that we have, on top of all the material problems, we have this tremendous educational and intellectual problem confronting us, owing to the fact of the immense increase of numbers. Well, now we have to ask ourselves, what should be our attitude towards this problem? We come to the other end of the bridge. We pass now from this world of facts to the world of values. How should we think about this? Well, I suppose what we think depends entirely on what we regard as the end and purpose of human life. If we regard the end and purpose of human life to foster power politics in a system of nationalism, then we shall need probably a great deal of cannon fodder, although even this now becomes rather dubious in the light of of nuclear warfare. But certainly this was the case in the very recent past with the idea of building up immense potential military forces. But if, as I think most of us would agree, that the end of human life is to realize individual potentialities to their limit and in the best way possible, and to create a society which makes possible such a realization of individuals, then we shall find ourselves equipped to think in a rational and philosophical way about this population problem. We shall see that in very many cases, the problem of raising human quality is being thwarted by the mere increase of human quantity. That quality is very often incompatible with quantity. We've seen in the case of education that mere quantity makes the educational potentialities of the world unrealizable. Then again, we've seen that the pressure of enormous numbers upon resources makes it almost impossible to improve the material standards of life, which after all have to be raised to a minimum in order to realize any of the higher possibilities. For although it is quite true that man cannot live by bread alone, still less can he live without bread. That only when he has bread, only when his belly is full, is there some hope of something else emerging from the human situation. And if we simply cannot provide adequate bread, then we cannot provide anything else. Then there is the political problems. It's quite clear that as population presses more and more heavily upon resources, the economic situation tends to deteriorate, becomes more and more precarious. There is a tendency, therefore, for centralized government to take over more and more control of a difficult situation, and therefore a tendency towards totalitarian forms of government, which certainly we in the West find very undesirable. And then there's another political corollary of this. In a population where two-thirds of the people are living on 2,000 calories a day and one-third are living on over 3,000, which is happens in many parts of the world, and then you ask whether democracy is possible, the answer is no, because the people on less than 2,000 calories will simply not have enough energy to participate in the political life of the country, and they will, in effect, be governed by the well-fed and energetic. So here again we have something which where quantity militates against quality. Then we have another thing, another, to me, very disturbing and painful thing, consequence of this, which affects the quality of human life, the fact that more and more of this increasing mass of people is being confined to gigantic cities, and that more and more people are therefore living completely out of touch with the their natural environment, and surrounded by an environment of unutterable dreariness and squalor. Because when one comes to think of it, there probably never has been a beautiful city of more than, say, 200,000, 300,000 inhabitants. Because the beauty of a city, a beautiful city, is beautiful in relation to its natural surroundings. You can have cities with magnificent central areas, such as Washington, D.C., but my goodness, if you walk about out of the central areas of Washington, D.C., it cannot be said to be very beautiful, and you will go through square miles of extraordinarily dreary slums and second-rate middle-class residential areas, And the same thing is true, of course, of these much larger cities, such as New York and London and Tokyo. You go through, there are miles upon miles of fearful dreariness where the children never see any natural object at all and see only ugly human objects. And this is something which is a blight upon the world at the present time, and as far as I can see, is destined to get worse and worse. And I cannot help feeling that this is a very deleterious state of things for the human spirit. Well, finally, the unlimited increase in numbers practically guarantees the destruction of our planetary resources and practically guarantees that within 100 or 200 years, an immensely hypertrophied human species will have become a kind of cancer on this planet and will ruin the organism, the quasi-organism on which it lives, which is a most depressing forecast and possibility. I think one can say that in the last analysis, this problem of quality and quantity is really a religious problem. For after all, what is religion? Religion is a preoccupation with human destiny, a preoccupation with the destiny of the individual and with the destiny of societies and the race at large. This is summed up very clearly in the Gospel, where we are told that the kingdom of God is within you, but at the same time it's our business to contribute to the founding of the kingdom of God upon earth, that this is a question both for of individual destiny and of the destiny of the society and of the race upon which individual destiny so enormously depends. We cannot neglect either of these two aspects, and if we neglect the general aspect, the quantitative population aspect of destiny, we do undoubtedly condemn ourselves, or certainly our children and grandchildren, as individuals. We shall condemn them to a kind of life which we should find intolerable, and which presumably they will find intolerable too. And there are, I know, certain theological objections to certain methods of population limitation. Most religious organizations in the world today, both within the Christian and outside the Christian pale, accept this, but the Roman Catholic Church does not accept any method of population control, except that which was which was promulgated and made permissible in 1932, the so-called rhythm method. Unfortunately, where the rhythm method has been tried on a considerable scale in an undeveloped country such as India, it has not been found to be very effective. So that there is a practical problem here. The fact that the Church certainly recognizes this problem was brought home very clearly in 1954 at the time of the first United Nations Population Congress, which took place in Rome in that year, when the late Pope, in an allocution to the members, to the delegates, made it quite clear that the problem of population was a very grave one, which he recommended to the consideration of the faithful. The present attitude towards the methods of control will be changed, I don't know. It's a matter of some interest that one of the main arguments against current and possibly future methods is their unnaturalness, and that this argument, precisely the same argument, was used in the Middle Ages, in fact used right up till the 1515, against the taking of interest on money. It was an argument based on statements in Aristotle that money is barren and has no right to breed. You find, a hint of this is to be found in The Merchant of Venice, in the first act where Antonio is talking to Shylock. He speaks about your barren metal breeding, and he asks, or is your gold and silver ewes and rams? That it was all right for living creatures to breed, but it was quite wrong for money to breed. Well, this was the position in the early Middle Ages, and it was gradually modified, and the last modification took place at one of the Lateran councils in 1515. And this represents a very fundamental change in attitude, and it's I don't know whether a similar change may take place in this same type of argument which is used at the present time. But be that as it may, the fact remains that everybody agrees on the principle that overpopulation is a great danger, and that the difference is now mainly on questions of means. So that we can conclude then by saying that this is quite clearly one of the gravest problems which confronts us, and that the choice lying before us is either to let the problem be solved in the most horrifying way possible by nature, or else to find some intelligent and humane method of solving it, simultaneously increasing production and balancing births, the birth rate and the death rate, and in some way or other to come to some kind of agreed international policy on the subject. And as I say, to my mind, the most important background to such a practical policy is, first of all, an awareness of the problem, and then a realization, as I said, that it is a profound religious problem, that it is a problem in the field of human destiny, which is essentially the field of religion. And this is something that we all have to think about and keep in mind, and, as I say, to think in this essentially religious and yet practical terms. Our problem, as always, is to be realistically idealistic.